Part 2. Ghost Legion. In the shadows. We pressed forwards, hugging walls and corners, trusting to the chameleonic plates of our armour to shield us from watchful eyes as the city burned around us. The armed forces of Trulla had a preference for high-powered energy weapons that were devastating when they hit, but also had a tendency to set fires when they missed. Several of my brothers, Ferris, Mortarion, Perturabo, even Russ, would have taken the enemy's strength as a challenge and met it head-on. Several of my brothers are fools. An enemy who does not shoot is no threat. An enemy who shoots blindly is as much a threat to their own side as they are to yours. An enemy whose shots can be guided is an asset. We had studied Trulla closely before engaging, before they had even heard of the Imperium, seeking to understand not just their strength of arms, but also their culture. Such a process took time, of course, but that was why I had begun sending my human agents far and wide as soon as my father had launched the Great Crusade, seeding them into pre-compliant societies. He wanted to bring his golden light to humanity and see it flock to his banners. I was planning for the alternative. He didn't know. He didn't need to know. Many of my agents did not fulfill their original purpose, it's true. Some died, some had been sent to planets and systems that my legion never went near, although even there they still had a role to play. Who can say how many seemingly chance occurrences, how many enemy missteps, how many abrupt surrenders to my brothers were brought about by the actions of my network? And of course, once in place, my agent's usefulness was not expended. I could pull on strings in many places, should the need arise. Some hypno-conditioned, some whose loyalty ran bone deep. All assets that were useful and yet disposable. However, my agent's greatest successes came where I was in the theatre of war myself, and could utilise their placement to the greatest effect. For example, having all your armed units continuously broadcast an ident code to identify and locate them to overall command is a wonderful idea in theory. In practice, an enemy might be able to break into and override that code in approximately half of your units, instead replacing it with the slogan of a vicious uprising that occurred some 50 years previously and nearly tore your society apart. That can lead to a lot of angry, trigger-happy people, especially when there have been a few notable sabotages of prominent cultural locations in recent weeks. Suddenly, the enemy has revealed themselves, and the enemy wears your face. A half-buried cultural memory rears up, and the state of heightened alert disintegrates into an abrupt and bloody civil war. Loyalists fire on those broadcasting subversive slogans. The supposed subversives, unable to shut off their equipment, and because of the recent tensions, given insufficient time to explain themselves, shoot back in the interests of self-preservation. How could this be the work of an outsider? How would they know your history? Besides, they would have targeted military installations, ammunition dumps and communication relays, not memorials to fallen heroes or the statues of the first founders. In reality, we did target all those locations. We simply didn't strike until the Trullans were already tearing themselves apart, and were so intent on purging their own that they weren't looking for anything else. When your enemy is apparently shouting to announce their presence, silence is seen as little threat, until it's too late. The preparation had been taking place for years. Our covert hostile action had begun 5 Terran weeks ago. In terms of direct military action, we had been in the field for a matter of hours, and the majority of the planet was already ours for the taking. Now the capital was aflame, and thick smoke filled the air, along with the sizzling report of energy weapons and explosions as fuel lines detonated, or another gunship or troop transport was shot out of the sky by one side or the other. The general populace was cowering in panic, the security forces were at war with themselves, and no one was paying much attention to the 6 figures in Mark IV plate advancing on a main road intersection through the night shadows. The local lumen equivalents overhead had gone dark. One of my teams had detonated explosives in the local sub-relay 7 minutes previously. I had four headhunters with me, Eltan, Dersius, Jar Tenor, and Hymor, and one member of the Librarius, Akil Gukul. I was playing the role of the headhunter prime, and was clad, as my companions were, in camellia-line-imbued legion plate. We were not here to bring word of the Imperium, for Trulla would be too proud to accept it. We were here to gut this society and leave it floundering, likely desperate for strong leadership, and even if not, certainly too disorganized to put up more than a token resistance. The Imperial Fists would be here within 6 months, if my calculations were accurate regarding how long it would take their nearest expeditionary fleet to finish their current compliance campaign, and then move on to this, the next logical system. I wondered briefly if Rogel would suspect the hand of another. I doubted it. My 20th Legion were not yet known openly by their brothers. We had no recorded heraldry or colours, organisational charts, or even name. So far as the vast majority knew, even those who had insight into the Astartes project, the 20th Legion had not yet progressed to full uptake, let alone reached readiness to have a presence in the field. We were a ghost legion, the Emperor's secret sword. The Legionis Astartes were the Imperium's great champions, noble warriors who bestrode battlefields wielding mighty weapons and brought worlds into compliance through force of arms and the shining beacon of the Imperial truth. At least if you listen to Gilliman or Dorn or Fulgrim. They had no place for assassins, for saboteurs, for tactics that assailed the enemy's psychology as much as their physical presence. They knew one way of war, and they were very good at it. But their success had blinkered them. "Target status?" I demanded.
"Approaching,"
Gukul replied. He was not using an Auspex, but I did not doubt him. Some other legions might shun the use of Psychana powers, but I saw no reason not to adopt them. Any tool is worth using, so long as the wielder maintains focus and control. Gukul was one of our best. "Nature?" I asked.
"Three vehicles,"
Gukul replied, his voice slightly strained from effort. Having seen him performing similar tasks bareheaded, I knew that beneath his helmet his eyes would be moving visibly behind closed lids.
"Ground cars."
"How can you tell they're ground cars?"
Dersius asked. Although I couldn't see Gukul's face, the slight inflection in his voice suggested to me that he was smiling beneath his helmet.
"One of the drivers is thinking about the suspension. The target is in the centre of the middle one."
"Only three?" Jar Tenor asked. "Lord, are we certain this is the High Command?"
"We are," I replied. Other Primarchs might have bristled at being questioned by a line trooper. I did not. To be questioned, to examine your reasoning and conclude that you were indeed correct is one thing. To object to questions on the basis of your own superiority is to reject the possibility that you can ever be wrong. And that is a dangerous pinnacle indeed to balance upon. Similarly, questions should be encouraged. To do otherwise moulds a legion into an inflexible, rote-learned, homogeneous mass, whose warriors look permanently to their superiors for inspiration. Such a force could be effectively decapitated by a surgical strike on its leadership, which was, coincidentally, exactly what we were about to perform. I could hear the vehicles approaching now. How far the senses of power armour had come since that first battle outside the Lion's Gate in the driving snow, and I readied myself. I held a plasma pistol in one hand and a currently deactivated power spear in the other. The latter was not regularly issued to the legions, but I'd taken a fancy to the weapon type ever since impersonating the custodian Gerudo on Terra, and had adapted the design from the phoenix spears used by the Emperor's children. Already the other legions were adopting their own preferred methods of warfare, and jealously guarding their tricks and devices. Little kings setting up their own borders around their own little hills. What else could be expected from brothers who had been rulers in their own right before my father found them? Fulgrim didn't know we had his designs. I don't believe he even knew we existed, beyond the theoretical understanding that there was a 20th Legion somewhere, presumably still in the bowels of the Imperial Palace. and what he didn't know wouldn't hurt him. It would, however, hurt the Grand Overlord currently being borne towards us, or more accurately towards his emergency bunker, a route that took him past where we now lurked, while above us the sky flared as his underlings shot each other down. We waited as the sound of the vehicles drew closer, powerful engines being pushed to their limits. I gave no orders. Every warrior already knew their role. One engine abruptly dropped in tone and output, followed immediately by another. The foremost vehicle continued at its maximum speed and roared past us, sleek and dark, not overtly military in appearance, but clearly well armoured. The second ground car, in which the Grand Overlord rode, came into view a few moments later. Its pace was slowing now Gukul was influencing the driver, and the bolt guns of my squad opened up to greet it. Their salvo ripped through the protective metal and tore holes in its flank, but their primary focus was the driver's compartment. The vehicle slewed as bolt shells found him and pulped his body, and it drove headlong into the corner of a building on the other side of the intersection. Gukul grunted and dropped to one knee, just as the third vehicle, which had slowed to keep pace with the unexpected deceleration of the one preceding it, veered around the corner and came straight for us. A security detail, intending to sell their own lives to give the Grand Overlord time to get clear, if he still lived. It demonstrated admirable courage and training, and not even Astarte's weaponry could vaporize a ground car of that size and momentum sufficiently to prevent it from ramming us in the brief time we had. We dodged it instead. Eltan and Dersius went to our left and Hymor to our right, dragging the apparently stunned Gukul with him. Jar Tenna and I leapt straight upwards and over it. We hadn't planned for this, but my legion held to the general principle that an enemy offence should be avoided, not weathered as a matter of pride. I landed and heard the screech of tyres behind me as the ground car, realising it had missed us, attempted to kill its momentum. They'd signed their own death warrant. Eltan and Dersius would swarm the vehicle before it could move again, and would swiftly eliminate the occupants. Ahead of us, the first escort vehicle had realised what had transpired behind it, and had also slowed. Jar Tenna pulled two frag grenades from his belt, primed them, and threw them in one smooth motion. They arced through the air, flying farther and more accurately than any unaugmented human could have managed, and detonated beneath the ground car's chassis with enough force to flip it over. "Gukul," I asked without turning, as I advanced on the target vehicle.
"Forgive me, Lord," Gukul replied somewhat shakily. "I've never before been holding the mind of another when they were killed. The experience was unpleasant."
"We will note that for the future," I said. I heard a window smash as Dersius punched his way into the third vehicle, then an explosion as a venom sphere went off inside. The spheres were new developments of our own, an improvement on the standard frag grenade, incorporating trace elements of a crystal that had proved highly toxic to most forms of life, which we discovered on a planet in the galactic north. One or two members of the Mechanicum assigned to us had been reluctant to incorporate them. They had suffered unfortunate and entirely plausible battlefield accidents, providing opportunities for advancement within our ranks for more open-minded individuals. The loss was a shame, but my legion was still operating secretly, and we could not afford resentment risking that. The Mechanicum had to work for the advancement of the Imperium, after all. Any tool is worth using, so long as the wielder maintains focus and control. The rear doors of the stricken vehicle in front of me opened, and a bodyguard stumbled out on each side. They were elite soldiers, clad in the best body armour this society could produce, and bearing its signature energy weapons. But no mortal can go through the sort of crash they just experienced without consequences. I aimed and fired, disintegrating the head of one with a ravening bolt of plasma. The other managed to fire his weapon, but I was already rolling underneath the beam and came up to my feet in front of him with a thrust of my power spear that split his armour as though it were nothing more than silk. He drooped on the blade, and I hurled him to one side, then turned towards the vehicle. A figure scrambled out on the other side, awkwardly stumbling over the headless bodyguard lying there. It was the Grand Overlord. Picts of the man were common in this society, and we had researched our targets well. Even the back of his head gave me his identity. I hefted the power spear and threw it like a javelin. It planted between his shoulder blades and drove right through his body. He staggered and fell, his body racked with spasms of pain, then passed out from shock. He would not come around again. "Status," I demanded as I walked around the ground car to retrieve my spear. I raised my plasma pistol and fired it at the first car, still on its roof. The fuel tank caught, and the entire thing blew apart in a bright yellow flower of flame and debris. There would be no survivors. A couple of small pieces of metal pattered against my armor. I ignored them.
"No injuries, Lord,"
Dersius replied. I checked my chronometer. We had fulfilled our role within the time parameters allotted by the greater plan. Our extraction would occur in 10 minutes, half a kilometer to the south. My helmet's picked feed was being recorded onto a data slug, and I now broadcast the image of the Grand Overlord, face down on the road and very obviously dead, to one of my operatives on the other side of the city. We had just seized control of one of the main communication hubs. Until now, the citizenry at large would have had no idea what was going on, isolated as they were from the military channels. It was time for that to change. Fear and incomprehension at this sudden conflict would have risen, swiftly and sharply. Now they would get an answer, and it would not be one they liked. The airwaves began transmitting the same slogan as that which we had inserted into the military channels. It would be screaming at the populace from every frequency, and with it would come the image of their leader, murdered in the street. Not only would the reason for the apparent uprising become clear, but so too would exactly how successful it had been. There would be no reason for any of those who still harboured such beliefs to not reveal themselves, confident their cause was in the ascendancy. Even if there was no meaningful support for it within the populace, the citizens would turn on each other as virulently as their military had, convinced that those responsible for this atrocity lived amongst them. Had this been my legion's world to conquer, we would have let the disruption rise further, then eliminated any remaining military threats with a lightning assault from multiple directions. However, this world would simply have to tear itself asunder for a while before the Imperial fists arrived to bring it into the fold. I was sure that what he would find would reinforce Rogel's belief in the supremacy of the Imperium and its ways. That should please him.
"Lord,"
Elton asked, as we moved at speed away from the scene of our ambush, "will we get our own conquests in time?"
"Does it rankle," I replied, "to see your brothers from other legions amassing victories and being hailed as heroes?"
"It does, Lord," Elton replied honestly. "We have even taken on their colours at times, rather than use our own." I could understand Elton's hunger for recognition. He was an original member of the Legion, from one of the rare parts of Terra not already bled dry by the endless thirst of my brother's armies, although I had vastly expanded both our sphere and nature of recruitment since those early days. I did not have the same understanding of gene-smithing as my father, but I was aware the gene seed gifted to my legion was remarkably stable, and so we had been able to recruit some candidates that other legions might not have found suitable. I smiled inside my helmet. "Patience, my son. Content yourself with these thoughts. Firstly, some of their victories have been enabled by us, though they know it not. Secondly, while they will think the 20th to be lost and leaderless, you have in fact known your Primarch since you first ascended to the ranks of the Astartes. And thirdly, when it is time to reveal ourselves to the galaxy at large, we will eclipse them all." That prospect both excited and alarmed me in equal measure. I had my own hunger for recognition, which I had been careful to keep subservient to the needs of the Imperium. But to step out of the shadows after so long was not something I would do lightly.
"Lord!"
That voice did not belong to one of my companions. It came from the microbead in my ear, and I recognized it as belonging to Armillus Dinat. Dinat had proved himself to be one of my most capable commanders, and I had left him in overall control of this operation while I executed a frontline role, although in truth there should be very little to oversee, given the self-contained natures of our activities. He would not be communicating with me from the Alpha, my battle barge, which should have been concealing itself from enemy scanners behind the smaller of the planet's two moons, unless the matter was extremely urgent. Yes, I replied. There was no need to reprimand Dinette for this breach of mission protocol. Either it would be appropriate, or it would not.
We have just received a communication through the network. We may have found another brother.
A thrill of excitement ran through me. The Emperor had found Horus. There was no argument there. However, my network had been instrumental in reporting back and guiding us towards some of my other brothers, whom the Great Crusade had found. It had been immediately obvious to those who had arrived at Macragge, Inwit and Chemos, for example, that their rulers must have been the creations of my father. So I, and it must be said Malkador, nudged the direction of events so my brothers would be discovered sooner rather than later. However, of all my brothers, there was one whom I hoped most desperately to meet. Although I had felt kinship of a sort when I had laid eyes on those found so far, or without their knowledge, I had not yet discovered the one whose soul I could feel was bonded to my own. It seemed a strange notion, but I knew, with a certainty that outstripped virtually everything else, that somewhere in the galaxy there existed a brother with whom I could and would share everything. Acknowledged, I replied. Disengage all operatives and prepare for departure. I would not let this wait. The Imperial Fists could deal with this world in whatever manner they found it, and we had already prepared the way for them. Even as my headhunters, Gukul, and I reached the bridge outlined in our mission parameters, and we dropped over the edge onto the vehicle passing below, I tuned into the local broadcasts and heard the primitive, warlike chant that had apparently so damaged this society a generation ago.
Blood and skulls! Blood and skulls!
Dawn was welcome to this system. I had more important places to be. Rogel Dawn doesn't like me. In truth, I'm not overly fond of him either. It's hard to like your brother when he's so pompous, yet considers himself a humble servant. His armour is made from the same substance as our father's, and he has been given command of the Imperial Palace's defences. No one likes a braggart, but when you go attired for war in a manner reminiscent of the Master of Mankind, it behoves one to acknowledge that. Aggressive humility in such circumstances seems almost its own form of arrogance. Also, he never lies. I don't trust anyone who only speaks the truth. We only openly worked together once, in the campaign against the World Prince. After my Legion's intervention had rapidly speeded the world's capitulation into compliance by guiding the assassinations of almost all their ruling class in one night, Rogel berated me not only for helping him, but for doing so badly, in his view. He claimed my Legion's efforts had been effective, but not optimally so, by my own criteria. And in this he was both correct and misled. It was true that I could have ordered my forces differently. I could have waited until the situation became even less stable for the defenders, and I could have avoided the assassination of the ruling blood and allowed a less fractious eventual compliance. The fact that I did not, and that Rogel recognised this, tells us something. Firstly, it tells us Rogel believed my Legion should work as directed by the Imperial Fists, and that my method should be subservient to his. For a Legion and a Primarch so caught up in their devotion to the Emperor and the Imperium above all else, that is an interesting juxtaposition of supposed humility and unacknowledged arrogance. He and I are brothers, after all, and supposedly equals. I wonder if Rogel would have made the same demands had he been joined in the field by Horus. Or whether, since my Legion and I were perceived latecomers to the Great Crusade, he viewed that he had superiority by means of seniority. Secondly, it tells us that Rogel was aware of the potential for forcing compliance by means of non-military intervention, as well as his own successes in the field, but had made no efforts to bring this about himself. He always sees open combat as the only true method. Thirdly, it tells us that if you wish to find out whether your brother knows how you think, you should give him the opportunity to criticize your conduct and see what aspects he focuses on. He might indeed identify true failings that should be corrected, but he will almost certainly highlight his own blind spots and weaknesses, as much through what he does not say as that which he does. Why should I need to know this? Rogel has made the throne world his, in a manner no other Primarch has done. He has overseen its defences and tailored them to his own wishes. He is the Praetorian of Terra. Should my father fall for some reason, who else would the Imperium look to for leadership in the immediate aftermath of such a tragedy than the loyal, devoted son who stands in the Imperial Palace, behind the defences he has constructed, wearing armour that is, after all, so very reminiscent of our father's? I do not trust Rogel Dorn. And the legionnaires, now in stasis sleep beneath the Gobi toxic wastes, are evidence that I have not been idle.